I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to The Connection. 8 years ago, in 2015, a white supremacist, Dylan Roof, was welcomed into a Bible study class at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. He sat with the parishioners and then suddenly opened fire, killing 9 of them, including the pastor. It was a horrifying and vicious attack that was unforgivable in most people's minds. I certainly felt that way. And yet, a few days later, several family members of the victims addressed Roof at his indictment. They spoke tearfully of their pain, and they offered their forgiveness. Our guest, philosopher Maisha Cherry, said she was overcome with grief, sadness, anger, and worry. She writes in her new book, Failures of Forgiveness, that she was troubled by the fact that forgiveness was being depicted as something magical. Enchanted words that once spoken and performed could immediately heal wounds and racism. She says our notions of forgiveness are just too narrow and calls for a radical, more transformative kind of forgiveness that involves repair. Maisha Cherry is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of California at Riverside. She also directs the Emotion and Society Lab and joins us on The Connection. Maisha Cherry, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you with us. Let me begin with why you wanted to take on forgiveness. And I ask that because I do think forgiveness we think of as this kind of sacrosanct act of generosity and kindness, this hallmark of empathy and altruism. But you're really asking us to really revisit this act and perhaps do it better.
Yeah, I think when it comes to forgiveness, even when I talk about forgiveness, and particularly being a philosopher, it's not an abstract philosophical topic. I think everyone can kind of relate. They can admit that they have either forgiven or been a recipient of forgiveness. But I was noticing during these high profile cases of violence that forgiveness was being viewed as something that could solve all of our problems. Hmm. And there was something about it being uttered, something about it that I thought kind of with similarities in the sense that we was looking at it quite narrowly. So we were tending to think of it as all you have to do is let go of your anger, and forgiveness always involves some form of kind of reconciliation. And I just thought that that was a kind of narrow way of looking at forgiveness, that I thought that we need to broaden the ways in which we think about forgiveness. We need to broaden the ways in which we take who's involved in the forgiveness practice. And so one of the things that I suggest is that, hey, forgiveness is not just about victims, but it's about wrongdoers. It's about the community. And I think once we broaden the way we think about forgiveness and who's involved in forgiveness, I think a lot of problems that arise in the aftermath of wrongdoing, we can undo and prevent.
I was watching some of the people from the AME Methodist Church in Charleston, South Carolina, talking to Dylan Roof. It was obviously very painful to hear their words and the way they said them. Nadine Collier, whose mother, Ethel Lance, was murdered, said to him, "You took something very precious from me. I will never talk to her again. I will never hold her again, but I forgive you. God have mercy on your soul." And it's hard not to be so moved by those words and to wonder where in her heart was she able to find them?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
And I want to recognize that when you forgive under those circumstances, I mean, I consider forgiveness to be a gift to us, so it's not an obligation. And as you said at the start of our conversation, for lots of people, that crime was unforgivable. And so the fact that some family members, and I think it's important here, because the narrative, a lot of people thought that all of the family members forgave, and it was just a few of them that did pronounce their forgiveness. But when I think about that, I think that that was a virtuous act. I think that it was done on behalf of the memory of her loved one. It was done on behalf of healing for herself. And I want to praise that.
Sure.
But I think it's also important for us to also think about those who didn't forgive, and perhaps their actions were also praiseworthy too.
Well, and one more quote from a family member that talked to Dylan Roof saying about their sister. She taught me that we are the family that love built. We have no room for hate, so we have to forgive. And it's interesting that this sort of combination of hatred and forgiveness. How do you see them as kind of flip sides?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I conceive of forgiveness to be is that, hey, you can let go of anger, but you can also let go of hatred towards the wrongdoer. Right. So it's not just the anger part. You can let go of hatred. You can let go of contempt. You can refuse to engage in any kind of revenge. And so when you listen to the reports, which I think is important, when you listen to their testimonies, what they're trying to challenge us to conceive of forgiveness quite differently. Like there's even a quote where she says, you know, I have to learn how to do this.
Right.
It's not
right.
going to come easy. So there's a lot of lessons about forgiveness that is found in their testimonies. But it seems as if what we were, the headlines was just talking about their forgiveness, about them forgiving the unforgivable. And it's about that feel good narrative that I found a problem with. But I thought that what they were doing is something that I don't think that I could have done. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could have removed my hatred towards someone who took my family member away, but they definitely did. And they did it for a variety of reparative reasons. And I think that's admirable.
Which I do want to talk about. And just a little side note here, Dylan Roof, as I understand it, has never asked for forgiveness. He's never right. apologized. He's an unrepentant white supremacist. Is he owed an apology?
You know, I would wish that an apology was uttered. And this is the thing that makes their forgiveness so praiseworthy in so many ways. And in some ways, I'm sympathetic to reporters who couldn't help but put it in the headline. Because for a lot of us, not only do we look at his crime as unforgivable, but the fact that he never offered an apology. He never apologized to them. And I think this shows truly the kind of the gift of their forgiveness. And it also goes to show a lot of people think that when you forgive, that it's always something that you offer up to the wrongdoer. And I think for lots of them, as much as they show empathy towards Dylan Roof, they were doing it for their own reasons for themselves, right? They were doing it for the memory of their loved ones. They were doing it so they can have a better future. And it doesn't, this is kind of an important thing to remember. And I think one of the things that they show is that you can engage in forgiveness as a way to kind of transform your life, that a wrongdoer may have acted within their power to take something from you, but you can have a kind of power in which you take your life back, and it doesn't depend on the wrongdoer doing anything such as offering an apology. And there's something about that I find to be quite powerful.
So is forgiveness for the forgiven or for the forgiver, or does it vary from incident to incident?
I think it varies. I think it varies from incident to incident. I think I can forgive someone, and the forgiveness works for both of us. And mm-hmm. so in some ways, in me forgiving a wrongdoer, it does offer up some relief for them. And I seeing how overburdened they are about what they've done, that my forgiveness can offer some kind of hope. But in a lot of ways, I don't have to really be concerned about the wrongdoer at all. Right. I can forgive for my own reasons so that I can have some kind of repair for my own life. So I think it can go either ways. The forgiveness can be for the wrongdoer. But the forgiver can also be about the victim and the memory of the victim and the family, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you want us to enlarge this view of forgiveness. And I think the impulse is to kind of forgive and forget and move on and pretend it didn't happen or just kind of paper things over. But you're saying that is not enough.
No. There's an adage that says that we ought to forgive and forget.
Right.
I think that latter part is problematic. I mean, I think wrongdoing has an afterlife. And as much as we would like to forget everything that has happened horribly in our lives, there's a power in memory. And one of the things that I think memory serves is that it reminds us that the aftermath of wrongdoing doesn't go away, right? There's some consequences, there's some residue, there's some mess that wrongdoing leaves. And I think one of the challenges that we have to learn is to kind of live with the mess. There's a lot of regret, there's a lot of remorse, there's a lot of things that can't be undone. And we need to figure out how to wrestle with that. And I think the memory of it is to make sure that we don't repeat wrongdoing, that we recognize that what we do can't magically disappear, that we can hurt people, and that hurt can last for a lifetime. And so I think the memory of that can not only show respect to the gravity of the wrongdoing, but it can also serve as a reminder to not repeat the past. And so I don't think that we should forget anything. I think remembering and memory is a wonderful thing if we are to heal.
Well, you tell a story, a very personal story. Your mother was actually dying, and your stepfather brought another woman into the home to live with him and asked for forgiveness, which you refused to give him. You go on to say that you sort of have kind of reframed this whole thing to make it work for yourself. But nonetheless, what was your thought when he said, I want your forgiveness?
Well, at the time, so this was about 10 years ago. At the time, I just felt like in that moment, it was right before my mother's funeral. I felt like the request was perhaps inappropriate at the time. I think for a lot of our family members, we was grieving our mother. So the focus was really on our mother. And I felt in that moment, the focus was not on me relieving this person of any regret, remorse, or any emotions. I wanted to focus on celebrating the life of my mother. And so in the book, there's no doubt that I do talk about how we need to be careful about when we make requests of forgiveness. But that aside, I mean, I thought at that moment, I did not forgive him. I didn't have the time to forgive him. I was focused on other things. But as time has passed, me and my sister, we have dealt with that wrongdoing quite differently. And so I think she forgave way before I did. And there was a recent situation in which he reached out to the family. And of course, my sister has forgave. And so when she reached out to me asking, you know, if he could contact me, I said no. And her immediate response was, Maisha, why won't you just forgive him? And I thought for a moment, I have forgiven him. I didn't forgive him in that moment. But over the years, I have forgiven him. And my forgiveness just looked quite differently from my sister. So for my sister, hey, it's about, you know, letting go of anger. It's about no longer being angry with him. It's about reestablishing a relationship with him. And I felt that was narrow. I think that was the problem about how people was conceiving of forgiveness. And for me, my forgiveness, you know, I didn't have hatred towards him. So I let go of the hatred that I had. But I didn't want to reconcile. I had other reparative aims. I wanted to forgive him for myself and for the memory of my mother. And so I kind of was beginning to understand that this narrow view was causing some problems in my family. It was causing a misunderstanding between my sister. And I was just trying to see how this can't just be limited to my own family situation. I think lots of families were also suffering from people conceiving of forgiveness quite narrowly. And thinking that if you just grant them forgiveness, everything will work out. So forgiveness is a personal problem for me as well as a social problem for me.
Sure, no, I get it completely. I mean, you do go on to write to say that, yes, you don't wish him ill. You don't want anything terrible to happen to him. And that perhaps you understand what he did as a form of weakness. And perhaps that made it a little more benign.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to minimize the wrongdoing, but I think one of the things that's important is trying to empathize with someone who engages in a kind of wrongdoing. I think as much as I can't imagine myself forgiving Dylan Roof, I honestly can't imagine what I would do in a situation like my father's. Right. I can't imagine what it is to have someone on their deathbed and you being an emotional ruin. And what that is for you. And so the only thing that I can do is try to empathize and try to offer some kind of compassion, as much as I didn't like the action. Sure. I just felt that everyone is redeemable to a certain extent. And I think everyone can be understood without excusing their particular actions. And I think that empathy goes a long way.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Maisha Cherry is our guest today on The Connection. And we're talking about her new book. It's called Failures of Forgiveness. And it's subtitled What We Get Wrong and How to Do It Better. She is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of California at Riverside. She also directs the Emotion and Society Lab. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, so don't go anywhere. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Maisha Cherry about forgiveness, which, of course, is a very powerful act. It's not easy to do. And our guest says it often does not go far enough. And again, she's got a new book called Failures of Forgiveness. You know, that story you told about your stepfather, I know someone who forgave his father after his father had died. And he had learned more about what his life was about, things that actually were quite horrifying, and explained some of the things that his father had done with him that explained their relationship, and was able to forgive him even though he was not there, is not there, and now has such a better relationship with his father because of that. Does that make sense to you?
That does make sense. I mean, I think one of the important things is that I think that example kind of illuminates that forgiveness can look differently for different people, right? So for a lot of people, like I said before, you know, this narrow view that forgiveness always aims for reconciliation. But if your loved one is deceased, it's impossible to kind of reconcile in that particular way. So there's another aim. And I think for the individual, that goes to show that forgiveness doesn't just aim for reconciliation. It can aim for repair, can aim for release. And I just think that it really illuminates that forgiveness is much more than we think it is.
How about forgiving ourselves? You have a whole section on this, and
that's much
you know, and to be honest, I have to fully confess here. I, you know, for a time during high school, I was a mean girl, and I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed of myself for having done some of the things that I did. It wasn't long lived, and hopefully, I've lived a better life. But nonetheless, there are things that I did that were hurtful, and I truly regret them, but I haven't repaired them, as far as I know.
Yeah, that's tough. I must say that forgiving my stepfather has been much easier than forgiving myself. There's
really?
Moments.
Really?
Yeah. There's moments in which, I mean, if we go back to my mother's example, you know, there's moments, you know, my mother died when I was in my late 20s. And for those who have been in their 20s, you know, that's the selfish years, right? You're really caught up in kind of creating a life for yourself and a career for yourself. And so you don't go home as much. I didn't go home as much as I wish that I had. And so when my mother passed away, all I could think about was the times in which she asked me, hey, when are you coming home this weekend? Uh-huh. And so I have regrets. I have remorse about, quote unquote, not being the best daughter that I can be. And I'm filled with lots of remorse. And there's moments in which, you know, I can go be going about my day. And I remember these moments in which I wasn't the best daughter. And that's very painful. I call them intrusive memories, right? They're very, very painful. It's so hard forgiving yourself because I think you hold yourself up to a particular standard. And there's nothing like disappointing yourself, right? Because you know what you can do. And so it's easy to have compassion for other people, but less to have for yourself. But I think just because it's more difficult doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be done. I think one of the challenges that we have to do is just try to learn from the mistakes. Mm-hmm. Trying to be better. I'm trying to be a better sister. but that's all we have to try to do much better in the future.
I mean, it is hard because we have to live with ourselves, right?
Right.
We can't.
Right.
Yeah, we can't blame anyone else. And I wonder whether. You think that how serious a problem you think that is, that we beat ourselves up for things that we have done in the past, or maybe that is appropriate.
Yeah, I think beat yourself up is good. It's how long you're going to beat yourself up with that can be the problem. Right. So if you wallow in too much self-reproach, then you're never going to give yourself an opportunity to do better. Right. And I think beating up yourself in disproportionate ways is the thing that keeps us stuck. And so I think the challenge is, OK, how do I challenge myself? How do I, you know, deal with this regret that I had in ways that's healthy, in ways that give me motivation to continue to do better in the future? So I think there needs to be a balance there.
Well, let me ask you a practical question then. How does one ask for forgiveness, or can one ask for forgiveness?
Yeah, so I think you can. I think it really depends on the context here. So if you want to get practical, we got to add all these these elements in it, right? So it could be the case that you are making an apology to someone. And let's say it's been years since the wrongdoing has been done. And you just want to let this person know, hey, I don't minimize what I've done. I want to acknowledge that, you know, that what I did was messed up, and acknowledge the hurt that has happened. And I just want to let you know that I'm sorry. And it could be that you offer up, you know, a kind of desire for forgiveness. So, mm-hmm. And I think the desire is important here, because I think you can say, hey, I messed up, and I hope that you can forgive me someday. I think that's quite appropriate. I have a problem with asking for it in that particular moment, mm-hmm. because I think that an apology is a gift. And so when you come to someone with an apology or with a gift, asking for forgiveness is like asking for a gift. So that's kind of odd to me that you're going to bring a gift, but then ask for a gift back. And so I think that's probably inappropriate. But I also think there's a variety of other ways in which you can probably, you know, check in and see if someone has actually forgiven you. So say, for instance, we have a friendship. And I messed up and we haven't talked in a while. And then you decide to call me and ask me if I want to go out. And I may want to take that as a sign that you have forgiven me. And to be clear or to be sure, I may ask, so have you forgiven me? I think that's, you know, that's appropriate. But I think that, you know, you can ask in a way that can put pressure on people. I think those press conferences in which reporters were asking victims if they can find it in their heart to forgive after police violence, I think that was kind of inappropriate to publicly put people on the spot to ask too quickly. So there's problems with requests. There's problems with apologies. And I think that's what I want people to realize, that although these are great moral tools, that we need to be very careful when we ask for it, how we ask for it, and what environment we ask for. So to be very, 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 very careful that in asking, we don't put pressure and create more harm.
Well, and just picking up on that, and I think we've all seen those interviews where a member of the media has asked someone about forgiveness, wanting what? A kind of a happy end to the story, a positive narrative to be able to share with listeners or viewers?
I think so. And I'm sympathetic. I'm sympathetic to that.
Sure.
Right. These are tense moments that it's a lot of racial tension in which all of us are kind of implicated in a way. And you want to, as a citizen and as a reporter, you want to do what you can do to kind of, let's just say, give us a future or hope. But I still think no matter what the intent, you still could be doing more harm in the world. And so asking those victims what's in their heart when we don't even know their last name or we don't have a relationship with them, asking them publicly, putting them on the spot and treating the forgiveness question as if once I print this or once this person answer my question in the affirmative, everything is going to be okay. Right. And I think that's not the case. Right. In order to really go about the work of repair, it's going to take more than a victim saying, I forgive this white supremacist, right? It's going to take for us to kind of try to get certain kind of policies in place. It's going to take for us to do our part in our individual lives to put an end to racism and to be people of peace. So I just think that we need to be very, very careful. I think happy endings are great. It's something that we should strive for. But life is not always about happy endings.
Indeed.
Things are messy. And to restore things, you know, requires much more work and much more effort than the happy stuff. And to live with that. It's okay for things not to be happy at each turn. That's perfectly fine. And we need to be comfortable with the discomfort so that we can truly repair.
Indeed. And you have actually a really interesting section about, instead of questions about forgiveness, do you forgive someone when someone is in sort of the heat of their suffering and misery? You say, why not ask, what do you want to tell us? What
right.
can we do for you? What do you want to happen? That those are actually perhaps more humane kinds of questions to ask someone who has, you know, just experienced the worst thing in their life.
Right. I mean, we're so... And as much as I'm saying something about the reporters, I think the reporters really represent each of us as individuals.
Sure.
We do want to read, you know, certain kind of happy endings, and we want to tell these kind of positive narratives. But I think in doing so, it's like we're telling a story. And I think we need to put focus on victims and allow victims to tell their own stories. And I think so much has been taken from them in wrongdoing. So I think giving them agency back to speak for themselves is very important, despite kind of our optimism or what can be toxic optimism. So I think there's better questions to ask victims that won't put them on the spot, that won't pressure them, but can allow them to tell their story. So what do you want to tell us? What do you want to tell us about your loved one? Right. Well, particularly in cases of state violence, we know that the loved one is perhaps no longer around. You know, there's only one side to the story that's being told because of the deceased loved one. We know that sometimes the media has a tendency to always talk about the bad that they've uncovered about the wrongdoer. And so I think when you ask victims, what do you want to tell us? It's giving the narrative back. It's giving the power back to the victim. I think that's a powerful thing. And I think asking them what they want to happen or what they want to happen going forward, I think it's also very, very powerful because it allows us to kind of be attentive, to listen to their needs and their concerns. And I think when we do that to victims, then we're able to really get to the work of repair that we're after and those inappropriate questions.
You're really talking about and underscoring this sort of pressure to forgive someone. And perhaps that comes from people's faith or Christianity or various forms of religion that talk about the power of forgiveness, but you're really pushing back on that.
Yeah. Forgiveness can be powerful.
Sure.
But also putting our light onto justice can be just as powerful, right? Us focusing how we can restore our world is also powerful. And I think when people say forgiveness is powerful, what I hear them saying is what the victim does is powerful. And one of the things I'm trying to remind people of, if we are to create a better world, it's not going to take just victims doing stuff with their emotions. It's going to take all of us playing an active world to active role in creating a better world. And so I think the forgiveness question just put too much pressure. And here's the thing, a victim can't do it all. It's just impossible. Yeah. And it goes into this magical thinking about what one individual can do or what forgiveness can do. And I'm just trying to remind people that the work of repair doesn't stop even when the victim says, I forgive you, nor is it impaired when a victim says, I don't forgive. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done if we are to repair our world, and forgiveness, to stop at forgiveness, I think is just not a good, it's not a good look.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Maisha Cherry. She's a philosopher. She's also an author, and her new book is titled Failures of Forgiveness, What We Get Wrong and How to Do It Better. Are there times, though, when it really is appropriate to withhold forgiveness because it doesn't meet the moment, so to speak?
I think so. If you go back to the moment in which I was talking about my stepfather, yeah. It was just an inappropriate moment for me to do that. I mean, I didn't have my emotional resources were really focused on my mother's funeral. and so in some ways for me to use those emotions to focus on anything else, I think would have been disrespectful to the moment, to the moment of the memory of my mother. But I think if we go back to the social context that we've been talking about, Or even a personal. I think sometimes I think we should withhold forgiveness because the wrongdoer just hasn't acknowledged their wrongdoing. And if we care about the wrongdoer to a certain extent, maybe we want to wait a little bit, right? If we really want the wrongdoer to kind of fess up, to be better, sometimes withholding it is for their benefit. But I also think that withholding can be a radical act. It can be a revolutionary act. It can be an act that pressure us all to kind of do our part. And so if I realize that people are just talking about forgiveness as if forgiveness can do all the things, when what we need to do is to change policies, then I can withhold as a way to resist that kind of narrative, to kind of challenge the community to do their particular part. So I find it very powerful to withhold forgiveness. I mean, also, for matters of safety, for matters of concern, I think it can be a wise thing to withhold forgiveness in order to protect oneself and one's family. So I think just as forgiving people can be radical and inspirational, I think withholding forgiveness can just be as radical and inspirational.
You've talked a lot about repair, and you talk about superficial repair, which obviously doesn't really address or fix the problem, and radical repair, which really gets in, identifies the problem, and figures out what to do with it. How possible is that?
I think it's possible. I think it's a lot of work. And so to me, superficial repair is you do enough work for it to look good on the outside, right? So you ask the forgiveness question in a news conference so that you can, you know, have a wonderful article that's optimistic and positive, right? But you know, haven't really addressed the root of the problem, right? State violence is still happening, but you know, white supremacist violence is still happening. Radical repair is quite different, right? When you aim for radical repair, whether that's with forgiveness or without forgiveness, you're really trying to address the root of the problem, right? So as opposed to thinking forgiveness can do it all, you're trying to figure out how can we root out white supremacy and young people. Right? How can we really root out police profiling? How can we really root out the wrongdoing that's happening in our family that keep repeating itself, right? And getting at the root of that. I mean, that's a lot of work.
It is.
Right?
It
is. Not going to be, you can't post the family picture on instant social media real quick, right? After you have the conversation. But I think the work is worth it in the end. And I think, you know, we live in a society in which things, you know, people want to, you know, heal their lives and change their lives in 30 days or less. And radical repair to really get at the root and fix some problems, it's going to take much more time than that. But it's worth it.
Well, it's worth it. And you write about South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, both the pros and the cons. But here was a country trying to address the horrors of apartheid. How well do you think they did in sort of repairing this part of their history and their country?
Yeah, I think they were aiming for radical repair. So they weren't just aiming for the superficial stuff. And you know this because most of people have a memory of survivors' families, you know, kind of crying and basically offering their forgiveness. But what a lot of people don't realize is that, hey, there was a lot going on to usher in a new South Africa. So it was these human rights violation hearings, but there was also a reparations committee, right, trying to get things back. There was an amnesty commission in which people was trying to figure out how we should handle justice on behalf of the wrongdoer. But there was also a truth. So it wasn't just these people in these hearings testifying, but they were going back into the community trying to literally find out where the bodies were buried. And so, you know, they were getting that radical repair because they weren't just relying on forgiveness to do all the work to kind of restore South Africa. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from that. However, we ought to be careful in thinking that, you know, forgiveness can do it all. Or that forgiveness, you know, all it takes is just uttering forgiveness in that particular moment. I think when you go back to the archive of South Africa, you know, a lot of people say, hey, you know, there's moments in which I was participating in the hearings and I did not forgive, and people made me feel bad about that forgiveness. So we want to make sure we don't repeat that kind of mistake. But also what we're realizing with South Africa, I mean, I've been there several times. They're on the road to radical repair, but it's a process. There's still a lot of inequity and social inequality there. So it's a work in progress. So apartheid has ended, but there's still a lot of problems that they're contending with. And I think what we can learn from that is that healing and repair, it doesn't happen in an instant. And, you know, trying to move towards a better future doesn't happen sometimes in a decade, that it's a road towards repair. And I think we need to remind ourselves of that fact.
Well, and I wonder, you mentioned reparations. I'm thinking also the Catholic Church and the lawsuits as a way to kind of demand an apology, probably without forgiveness. But nonetheless, how do you see that? We have about a minute before our break here, but how do you see the role of money and reparations when it comes to forgiveness?
Hey, sometimes you have to bring evidence that things can be repaired, right, and that you're fully willing to repair some things. And sometimes money can help with that. So if you've stolen land, if you've stolen people's history and you want them to kind of preserve the history that they have left, that may requires money to do just that. So money can help. Money can't do all the work. But I believe it can help. And particularly in capitalistic nations in which capital and wealth is a huge thing, we ought not to ignore that sometimes if we are to repair things, we're going to have to repair things with some resources. Because for people to repair their world, it requires not just emotional resource, but also monetary resources as well.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation here on The Connection. And again, Maisha Cherry is our guest. She is a philosopher. She's written several books and the newest one is called Failures of Forgiveness, and it's subtitled What We Get Wrong and How to Do Better. And she's a professor of philosophy at the University of California at Riverside, and she also directs the Emotion and Society Lab. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about forgiveness. It's a powerful act. It's not easy to do. And our guest philosopher, Maisha Cherry, says it often doesn't go far enough. We're talking about some of what she writes in her new book, Failures of Forgiveness, What We Get Wrong and How to Do It Better. And she calls for more radical, transformative kind of forgiveness. Well, we talked about South Africa. We talked about the Catholic Church. Let's talk about the United States of America and slavery. And, you know, how do you see forgiveness and slavery and even apologies as we grapple with our history and frankly, the legacy of our history?
Yeah, so we just talked about the South Africa case and Eden alluded to the Canadian case. And one of the things that we've learned from both of those contexts is that they have engaged in what I call a political project of reconciliation. There was reparations committees. There was truth hearings. There was, reparations that were given to survivors, all that stuff. But when I look at the United States context, and particularly, you know, kind of trying to figure out what we should do with slavery, we haven't even made it to the truth part. So first of all, it hasn't been a political project of reconciliation. We still have that to happen for the United States, which is odd.
Especially after so many years, right?
So many years. Come on, United States. So it's odd that we haven't engaged in a political project. But I think what is not so odd about this, you know, I'm very much influenced by the work of James Baldwin, that there is something about America trying to deal with itself, trying to be truthful about who it was, who it is, and who it should be. And just like any, you know, we know people who are in denial about their wrongdoing, who try to fix it up, who try to tell a particular kind of story about themselves. I know people like that who has never done wrong and who likes to look good in front of everybody. But as long as you are that person, you would never get better. And so I think if we are to really repair our racial condition in the United States, it's going to have to be a political project of reconciliation in which, first of all, we are truthful about the past. Banning books is not a way to be truthful about the past. Stopping certain classes from being taught in our university is not a way to be truthful about the past. So even before we talk about the reparations part, I'm concerned about we can't even be truthful about the realities and the atrocities of slavery. So I think that's important first before we even get to the reparations questions.
How do you see, you know, taking down statues of Robert E. Lee or building museums or monuments to African-Americans or to African-American leaders? Is that sort of a half apology?
Well, I think apologies need to be explicit, right? So you can undo a wrongdoing. And so when you allow certain kinds of white supremacists, no matter what role they've occupied, to be memorialized, you know, in front of state buildings, then a way to kind of repair that wrongdoing is to take them down. But that's not the same thing as an apology, right? And I want to separate these things, because reparative work, apologies, forgiveness, et cetera, they all do different kinds of things. And one is never a replacement for the others. I think those efforts of bringing statues down, those are good efforts, but hey, there's more to be done. And we need to welcome ourselves and be up to the task of doing much more.
How do you see you sort of reference this, but how do you see then the role of race and even gender and the role that it plays in forgiveness? If a white person does something or a black person does something, do we respond the same or do we respond differently?
No, and that's one of the things that really captivated me about our rhetoric of forgiveness that was being used publicly, because I was noticing that these requests for forgiveness were being made when the victims were black and the offenders were white. And they were being made, these requests were being made to primarily women. And I began to think about, hey, it's appropriate, but also look at who's being asked and who's being asked on behalf of. And I think that just goes to show kind of the racial and the gender dynamics of this beautiful concept that we've termed as beautiful. And I think for me, it just goes to show several things. But one, it goes to show that there are certain wrongdoers that are perceived as redeemable in our eyes, right? So white males, hey, of course we should forgive them because they're redeemable. But however, we don't offer up or talk about forgiveness when the perpetrator is black. And we got to ask ourselves, why is that the case? Perhaps because we don't believe that black people are redeemable or worth redemption. And so we got to kind of think about that. But the challenge, I think, is not to suggest that forgiveness is never relevant, but change the ways in which we have allowed it to be gendered and racialized, because everybody is worthy of redemption. And so forgiveness should always be at least an option on the table, no matter who the wrongdoer is.
You write about something called the hurry and bury ritual. How does that work?
So, you know, going back to these requests that I was talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
What was fascinating about these requests is that they were being made, and this is going to kind of break down why I call it hurry and burial. They were being made like right after the shooting. In many cases, before the funeral. In many cases, before an indictment, right? And I was fascinated about why were people in a rush to talk about forgiveness and to get these victims to forgive. So that's the hurry part. The bury part is, you know, forgiveness was being written about and talked about to the point that honestly, I forgot what people were forgiven for. Right. And so in some ways, forgiveness was obscuring, or talk or rhetoric about forgiveness was obscuring the wrongdoing. So And it was being, these questions were being, you know, asked like all the time in relationship to these high profile cases of police violence. So I called the hurry and bury ritual Because I don't think that just reporters engage in this process. I think when it comes to our family, we want to hurry up and solve the problem. We don't want any conflict. So we immediately ask the victim to forgive. I mean, so what we need to be careful here, that just like I needed time to forgive my stepfather, right? We need to allow for victims time to deal with the hurt, to deal with the wrongdoing, and to rush them to do it is to minimize the wrongdoing, is to take away their agency, and it's also to disrespect them. And so I think the challenge for all of us is don't engage in the hurry and bury ritual of any kind. Don't quickly ask people to forgive. Be patient. Be empathetic. If they want to forgive, they will surrender their forgiveness. They don't need for us to be to ask them all these questions during this awful time of their lives.
Do you have an example of what you think true forgiveness either looks like or feels like or has, what it has that makes it true and correct? And healing.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm trying to challenge people is that that's going to be subjective, right? So what I find to be true and correct is going to depend on who I am, what I am forgiving, what I want from the forgiveness. And I think the problem that happens is that what is true for us, we try to make true for other people. So for my sister, what was true forgiveness was letting go of anger so that he can be back in your life. Mm-hmm. But for me, true forgiveness was letting go of the hatred that I have towards him so that I can repair my particular world. And I think the challenge for all of us is that, hey, we need to broaden the way in which we think about forgiveness. Forgiveness can look different in very different contexts, and respect the truth and the trueness of someone's forgiveness, although we would like for it to look differently.
You wrote a book recently, I guess the book before this one, called Anger is Not a Bad Word. So it's interesting to think about forgiveness and anger. And you write about sort of an outraged forgiveness, that there is a place for anger in forgiveness.
Yeah, so there may be a time, I must say that even when we talk about my stepfather, I feel a little heat because yeah. I am still angry. So the anger is still there. I think the anger is still there because it just reminds me of the gravity of the situation. It still breaks my heart as if it happened yesterday because I consider what he did to be abhorrent. So I don't think the anger is going to go away. I think anger is a fitting response to wrongdoing. It respects the value of the person who was harmed. And so there's value there. And so one of the things that I like about what I'm doing is that I'm suggesting is that you don't have to let go of that anger in order to forgive someone. And I think that's powerful because for a lot of people, they have felt that they haven't truly forgiven or they haven't truly moved on because the anger reappears. But I think it's a sign of freedom. I think it's liberating to know that, yes, the anger may come and go. Mm-hmm. And that just goes to show that you respect the wrongdoer and you respect your own self. But you can still forgive in spite of it.
How do you see cancel culture when it comes to this notion of forgiveness and perhaps wrongdoing?
I think forgiveness and canceling is compatible. So I can cancel or no longer desire to be in a relationship with a celebrity and still forgive them. So I don't
think you have celebrities you're in a relationship with.
Well, transactional. Let me just say transactional relationship, right? I'm a fan. They entertain me, and I decide to give them attention if they decide to continue to entertain me. And if they decide to do something that's morally abhorrent, then I'm no longer a fan. But I can still forgive them. So as you can see, I think the two is compatible. Now, it's not to say that I can't do canceling wrong, right? It's not to say that I can, do some pylons and all that other stuff. But I think canceling is compatible with forgiveness. And I think what people are concerned about is, hey, if all this canceling is happening, then we're not going to forgive people or we're not going to be merciful. So people suggest, hey, we need to replace canceling with a forgiveness culture. Mm-hmm. But I don't like that culture talk because culture implies that we ought to forgive all the time, no matter what. And we ought to forgive because a whole bunch of other people is forgiven and forgiveness is the good thing to do. But I don't think forgiveness should be welded in that particular way. But so you can cancel and forgive and it's all good.
But I would argue that what you are saying in terms of assessing the damage, repairing the damage, doing some really hard soul searching is totally appropriate to dealing with forgiveness rather than the kind of forgive and forget culture that I think is probably much too common.
Yeah, because what a lot of people like to talk about when they talk about canceling is that they like to talk about, hey, you no longer support this particular person.
Right.
But what we know, particularly about our online practices of canceling, that it's not just canceling per se that happens, right? Canceling is usually the last part of the process. A lot of people call celebrities out, right? So they bring attention to the wrongdoing, right? They try to hold the wrongdoer accountable, right? And then if the wrongdoer doesn't, do their part, then canceling happens. And so I think a lot of people like to beat up on canceling as if it's not a moral practice. I think it is a moral practice. I think, celebrities need to be called out. They're often protected by their wealth. And if they do something bad, they should be called out. They should be held accountable. And in that way, that's one of the reasons why I don't want to get rid of canceling, because I understand that it's a way to keep celebrities and public figures held accountable to their actions.
But I wonder whether, what is the next step then, just to write them off, or is there something more that can be done?
No, not to write them off. I mean, here's the interesting thing. I wish I had a great influence over like celebrities' lives and we had
Don't
a
we all?
deeper relationship. But like you said, you kind of doubted that we were in relationship with celebrities. Well, we are in transactional relationships. I don't think LeBron would be heartbroken if I decided to no longer support him. Many people did once he left Cleveland. That's perfectly fine. But I think there's a point where, and this is just kind of what happens in our relationships. You try to hold, your coworkers to account. You try to keep them accountable. And if they don't want to be held accountable, then what more can you do? Maybe you need to say, hey, I'm not the one that can do this. Maybe someone needs to take over and hold them accountable, but I no longer want to be a part of this toxic relationship. I think that's perfectly fine. So just because I decided not to no longer support a celebrity doesn't necessarily mean that other people are not going to support and continue to hold them accountable. And I think that thinking that if I cancel, then what? Then if 50 people cancel, then what? I think people are always will be there to continue to work. And I think putting pressure on us as if we ought to be kind of a superheroes that save celebrities' lives, I think that's not the reality.
But you do make a distinction between these so-called transactional relationships of people that we do not know and people in our lives, and whether we cancel, whether and how and if we cancel them in our lives.
So we are in actual relationships with people who are in
Yes.
our interpersonal lives.
Yes.
And I think that requires a kind of different kind of responsibility, right? So LeBron, I mean, I can retweet something about LeBron James and he may read my tweet and may change his ways, although I think LeBron James is perfect. But that's quite different from me having a relationship with my sister, right? I don't want to completely give up on my sister because given the nature of our relationship, it requires something quite different, right? So I do want to continue to hold her accountable. And even though she doesn't respond to me, I don't want to let her go so quickly, right? I want to be a little bit more patient. And that my relationship requires patience in ways that doesn't really require that when it comes to a particular celebrity, right? But even after it's all said and done, if I decide that she's no longer going to change her ways, that I don't want anything to do with her anymore. I don't want to call that canceling, right?
Right.
Because canceling to me is just for transactional relationships. Let's just call it what it is. I have decided not to forgive her. Let's use that language. But I think to use the language of canceling in our personal relationships is to objectify our loved ones. And I don't want us to do that.
We're almost out of time here, but would true forgiveness, would that make us a better people, a better country?
I think true repair or radical repair will make us better. So forgiveness can't do it all. It may have to do other things other than forgiveness. But what I think is important is that we always keep our eye out on repairing our world, whether that's with or without forgiveness.
And do you think we're good at that? Yes. Sort of knowing, looking across the universe, right?
I think we're good at inventing stuff. We're good at restoring roads after earthquakes. And if we have that ingenuity within us, I think that's a reminder that we can also repair the messes that we make, and repair our worlds. So I think we have the resources. We just need to engage in the emotional work and the reparative work. And I think once we put our mind to it, I think we can get the repair that our world desperately needs. But we gotta put our minds to it.
In fact, and we're out of time here. You even say there is a kind of reparative instinct that humans have.
Yep. Yep. We want to repair roads. I want to do some repairs to my house. It's in us. And I think we need to focus on making sure that we use that reparative instinct, even when it comes to the things that are difficult for us or emotional for us or sensitive to us. It's in us. And I say, let's get to work.
Indeed. Well, Maisha Cherry, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. You've given us a lot to think about and talk about, though, so thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of California at Riverside. She directs the Emotion and Society Lab, and she's got a brand new book. It's called Failures of Forgiveness, What We Get Wrong and How to Do It Better. Well, thanks for joining us on The Connection. Every week we explore different aspects of what makes us human and unique. You can email us at theconnection@whyy.org and tell us what you want us to cover. You can check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, and sign up for our newsletter. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.